Yes, my people in from the Workers' Alliance headquarters writing leaflets and things like that, and that's why we had to continue getting our leaflets out on the job every week.
Were many of these people in the Workers' Alliance people that you had already had difficulties with who were members of the CP during the strike, or was it a different batch of people?
Those people were, now the people that we've had difficulties with, the CP faction, those people within the plants that had seniority or were working, they naturally would give their support to the Workers' Alliance. But even they, you know, it was a strange thing. There was a tremendous amount of respect for what the WPA unemployed in Local 12 was doing. It's a brand new thing. It was born, and we were getting headlines in the paper. The Workers' Alliance was, too, because this journal was very afraid of the leadership of it. But we were pretty dramatic during that time. They didn't think of any such thing as a death watch, you know. But you can see how completely immersed in Flint, Michigan I was at that time, can't you?
Were you aware of WPA locals in other cities at this point when you were beginning the reorganizing there?
Well, naturally, you read about them in the paper, you know, the little smidgens. We didn't have time for any. It's a strange thing. So this one conference in Pittsburgh has almost left my mind, you know, until I got the leaflet that I had forgotten about it. But we didn't have time for conferences.
Yeah.
We had one or two conferences in Detroit, but they were usually with just one select person from each section, very small meetings.
And under the aegis of the UAW.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they were they didn't have any ideas to offer to us in Flint. And I think that's why we just went right ahead with our own little housekeeping problems and our own organization right on the spot where we were.
We
had no guidance, by the way, from this international department.
You were just given the auxiliary status. And
that's right. That's right.
That would make you happy.
Now,
during this time, like in the early organizing of it in 39, you still were not on WPA. Kermit was on the WPA. Okay, so it seems like the first demonstration, and which also seems to be very shortly after you were, the local was organized, was on April 25th of 39. And apparently several hundred marched, were demonstrated outside of City Hall, and then there was a march from there, from City Hall, to the UAW CIO office. Do you recall anything about that demonstration? And that's the one where there seems to be a lot of anger and specific attacks directed against the city manager, Powell. Do you recall anything about that?
No, I don't, except that we didn't have very many signs at the time. I just remember that. And it was mainly people just shouting. And let's see. There was just a parade and shouting. And when we got in front of the city hall, there was a mass meeting, and we had some speakers, and Kermit was one of them, but I don't remember who the others were.
Well, apparently Workman was one.
Claude Workman? Mm-hmm. Yes, he would have been one.
And then I think that's the one that there was this other one, this person from Detroit, C. Walters, Detroit.
Oh, yes. Now, C. Walters was from the Socialist Party at that time. I don't think he went over into the SWP. I think he was still in the Socialist Party.
See, I gather that what this was going to the meeting of the city commission that was occurring. And it was a protest specifically against the 2.5 cents a meal relief level, and there were WPA workers being fired already.
There seems
to be protests against that. Now, do you recall who the bulk of the demonstrators would have been? Do you recall that?
What do you mean, who? I know they were men. The primarily, the professional projects were few in number compared to the big work projects. And those women were pretty well content. You know, the school canning projects and the library projects and all of these women, these projects that made room for women.
Mm. How about the sewing project?
The sewing projects were all women. Mm-hmm. Even, I think, the overseers of those, the supervisors. Mm-hmm. Excuse me, yes, they were women. So in these professional projects, it was a small minority, and they felt pretty good. They were learning. Some of them were learning a lot of things on these jobs also. And they felt pretty good about having these women having these jobs and feeding their families again. So practically everything that was done by the men on the outside projects. Mm-hmm. And any participation in demonstrations, usually they bring their wives along with them. Now, this wasn't too common even then. And when we talk about dances, they were more apt to bring their wife to a dance mm-hmm. than they were to some kind of a demonstration, because the men then thought they could handle mm-hmm. things like that, you know. And they thought the men had built the union by themselves and they could handle everything else. So we didn't have very many women.
Do you recall, you know, at that first demonstration, before the actual death watch was set up, was the body of the crowd primarily WPA workers at that point, or were the unemployed already directly involved in it?
They were mainly WPA workers at that point. We had to go to the unemployed and say, yes, there is a place for you, and you don't have to pay dues. They were so involved in just trying to hold their families together that to go to organize a protest, you know, was a big thing for them. And the beginning was the WPA workers. And if it happened to be at a time when an auto worker who perhaps was working 3 days a week, if it happened to be on a day when he was free, that auto worker would join, even from the beginning.
What about like the members who stayed within the Socialist Party? Would they become involved in a demonstration like that?
Oh, sure.
They were not part of the WPA?
Oh, sure. But let me think now. Getting back to it, Grover English was Buick. He had a lot of seniority. I don't remember his participating because he was working. Bruce Sloan was a sign painter. He wasn't, I think he left them shortly after that, too. I'm not sure. So he wasn't involved. Let me see. So Fred Stevens went back to bus driving. The driver said they were not hit by this. And of course, Carl Johnson was working because he had the highest seniority in the plant. So I don't remember the SPers. They were in sympathy with it, but I don't remember them playing any role in it, because they just weren't in they weren't involved. Mm-hmm. I don't remember any of them on WPA. That tells you that the age level of those peers were kind of high, too, if they had that much seniority.
it seems that the death watch thing was the very next thing that followed up very shortly after that. And for the tilt, it began about May 1st. Can you describe the whole planning of that and how you reached the unemployed, particularly, I guess, for the ones involved in
yeah.
the
work? These unemployed who had no more rent allowances given to them were evicted by the landlords, and the police, the sheriff was there to help evict them. And they would set all the furniture out on the sidewalk, and then we would take the mother and the children and put them in one big shelter. They called it a community center, but we called it just a shelter, you know. And they would feed them, the mothers and the children in one. The men were sent to a separate one. And we thought this was a horrible thing, dividing the families. The fathers being separated from their families, the furniture, God knows what, sometimes relatives could take it in their houses and so on, but this was primarily the reason for it. Okay, you're going to walk about 20 blocks here instead of taking off my time. Okay, now let me see, what was I talking about?
The shelters.
Oh yeah, the shelters. And, okay, so this is one of the things that we felt was horrendous. we didn't know quite what to do about it. We had tried all kinds of demonstrations, all kinds of negotiations, but it was just absolutely no doors open where we could solve this problem. Oh, we did first organize crews to go out and set furniture back in the house and to guard the house. But that became such an operation, mm-hmm. such a big operation. I remember with those crews, of course. And there were fights, and there were all kinds of black eyes and everything else that came out of that. So we decided to dramatize it so that everybody in the city of Flint would know. The papers were playing all of this down, the daily papers. Mm-hmm. And so we decided there was a huge, great big park with big oak trees right across from the welfare building and right on Industrial Avenue and right across from one of the plants of Buick. One division of Buick, so that the windows of the Buick plant faced on this park, and one side of the welfare department and its windows faced on this park, and the park was a square city block. So we decided to get, we advertised and got some great big huge army tents.
Where did you get them? Did you call?
There was somebody in the WPA union knew somebody who had one. This is the way. Where did I get the typewriter for these leaflets? Do you want me to tell you? All right. One night, my brother-in-law and another little guy who didn't have money for dental work and he had front teeth missing, and he thought that I was some kind of a goddess. He just worshipped me. And if I was able to put out their leaflets and I had no typewriter and I had to go to a union hall previously, I had to go to a union hall to use their typewriters to cut a stencil, and then we had to go run it off wherever we could. But this was hard. I had two kids. One night, about 11 or 12 o'clock, God knows, at night, they came up with a typewriter, an old Remington typewriter, and, I don't know, four or five cartons of cigarettes. And I said, where did you get this from? And especially the cigarettes, you know. Nobody had money for a carton of cigarettes, a pack or something else again. And they grinned and they said, don't you worry your head about it. Don't you worry your head about it. And I couldn't understand what in the heck happened, you know, that somewhere or another they got the typewriter. Don't ask about it. So after asking a dozen times, I just decided, well, don't ask. Use it for the union. But they did say, don't take it to the union hall. Use it for the department. So I was always worried about that typewriter for some reason or other. I never actually thought about it. They had gone into a gas station, broken into it, and got stolen the typewriter and the cigarettes. And brought them up to our apartment. So all of these WPA leaflets were typed on a stolen typewriter. So that's where we got the army tents. They were not stolen, but they had, you know, word would go out among the all these people.
Did the local have its own office, or did you have to use the offices of another one of the locals?
At that point, I think we had a little room. At the time of the death watch, I think we were able to rent a little room.
Mm-hmm.
No, it was a large room. That's right, because it had been torn down. It was a very, very old building. Mm-hmm. That, too, was on Industrial Avenue.
Because I know that the leaflets, there's one address on Industrial Avenue that's to come to the meeting or
uh-huh.
the dances. And then a little bit later it says, note our new address, which was still on Industrial Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
If you hear 26... That's 21. The new address, but the old one was also on Industrial Avenue.
And I guess that we did have the one room, 2317, uh-huh, and 2621. All right, the new address, this would have been the big one where we could have the dances. I don't know if we were able to have a dance in that one. The first one was just a little room, and it was so full, oh, so bare, bare wooden floors and bad walls, everything. But anyway, and we made signs and put up in the second one, and we began to look, and we got donated chairs.
Mm-hmm.
I think the local unions gave us some
mm-hmm.
folding chairs. They donated them to us. And they gave us a long table to
mm-hmm.
hold our meetings with. But outside of that, believe me, we had nothing.
So the time of the death watch, so you were in this small little place.
I think we were,
mm-hmm.
yes. Uh-huh. Because I remember they said, don't take it anywhere around any union hall. And I had that up in this little third floor apartment of mine. And
but
I did the typing up there.
The idea with the death watch was that when these families were evicted, they would come and to the tents.
Well,
in the park.
We could only get, I think there were actually only three families or four families. to move into it. Because remember, it's to be on display like a fish in a bowl. And to say I'm on release to the whole world and have the idol rich and everybody else come and stare at you like freaks or curiosity objects. It was not easy. The women particularly were very sensitive. And two of them had young babies with diapers and to nurse their babies and everything else and have people and in the public park. So anyway, we set up these big, I think there were two big army tents and one small camping tent. Then the rest of it was not too hard because people in Michigan go hunting to get food, you know, go deer hunting. And most every Michigan auto worker has a shotgun or a rifle. And they have a certain amount of crude camping equipment. So they had mats that they put down on the floors and they had some cots, army cot type of things that you use for camping when you go up north hunting. And I think we had one little Coleman burner, and then we had to have some, to keep warm, we had to have some metal barrels. And they built fires in those. There was just the holes cut underneath so that there could be a draft. And you could cook on them also. You could cook bigger pots than you could on the other. And so they actually cooked their meals, and most of the cooking was done outside of the tent because of the, with the barrels, naturally. You couldn't, too much of a hazard inside. And we had the other little ones in. And these mothers, and they had the quilts and everything, the children's clothes and everything there. These mothers would wash the baby's diapers on tubs of water on these drums, you know, hot water and soap, and they'd rinse them, and we strung up lines between the trees, and they'd hang up their kids' clothes and diapers for everybody to see. And when they were eating, they it was warm enough that they ate outside much of the time. But if there was too many people driving past, or they would shove the kids inside.
Did people come to see them?
Oh, that's what the value of the whole thing was. And on both corners, the main corners, by the plant and by the welfare building, we had a great big signs painted, this is the death watch. If people are going to starve to death in the city of Flint, then the whole city may as well watch them die. You know, very dramatic, but nevertheless, it was true, you know? And we did have babies that were dying in Hurley Hospital because the county doctor, Winchester, provided us with information. And he gave us actual statistics. He said, you don't need to let them know where you got it. But on such and such a case, these cases, they're putting down died of measles or mumps or whatever, you know, whatever the disease would be. Or malnutrition, or, but he said the actual fact of the matter is none of these babies' pneumonia would have died if it hadn't been just undernutrition and starvation. He said it should have been starvation. His baby could have been saved from this illness had it had the strength and it hadn't been undernourished all this time.
Well, you know, can you tell me a little bit about the four families? Were they very politically conscious people?
No. One of the women came from a coal miner's family, I think, and she felt that it was her duty to get out there, and her husband. And she was the one that had the nursing baby and, I don't know, three or four other little kids running around. The other family, they're hazy to me. She was very timid, very shy. And I'm thinking in terms of the women because the women bore the biggest brunt of this. The men, you know, they were on demonstrations, picket lines, and everything else. I can't tell you about them. I only remember that the one woman who would be out there and hanging up her clothes and doing whatever she had to do right out in the open, cooking and so on. She didn't look to the left, north, or right. She came from a coal miner's family. Her father had a rough time when she was a child.
Well, how did these four particular families become the ones that were doing that?
Because our union representatives went out to these eviction places and shelters and asked, they must have asked four dozen families before we got anybody to agree. And then we had to make the provisions of getting the tents and the rest of it, you know.
Was there an attempt?
And I think they took some of that furniture and put in those tents, some of that evicted furniture.
Was there an attempt by the city to have them removed or that you were violating city codes or anything when it was set up?
Oh yes, of course. We were warned. They didn't want to have too much of, because this was a big dramatic thing. They didn't want to have too much of a fight over this business. We were warned and served some kind of notice at the union headquarters. And, of course, for electricity, you know, we strung it right up from the city electrical wires. And it was, you could see it. We wired right up in there. Men that shimmied up these poles and connected the wiring themselves, which was illegal as hell and dangerous, may have been the consumer's power union men who did this for us. Because we had a lot of help on this. And then right directly down into the tents, you know, and the string hanging down with an electric light bulb from a clothesline or something, whatever they had hooked on in front of the tents. And at night you could see these bulbs inside, shining inside the tents, and then outside. Because we didn't want anybody sneaking up and setting fire to them or anything, so we had lights outside the tent, too. And it seems like we had a light bulb on one of those signs, so that could be seen at night, too, all night long. Yes, of course, we were served with notices, and the ranting and raving went on over the radio and in the press and so on. But they didn't take any overt action, and I think they would have discussed, they felt that the whole feeling of the town, you know, these people had gone through depression. These people had been, even if they were working in the shops, had been on WPA and had been through relief. And their sympathies were, you know, this was a very, very sensitive issue. Mm. And they knew families whose babies were crying for milk and who were hungry for a long period of time in that city.
But it was definitely seen as an action by the union. So
yes, we had WPA Local 12, UAWCIO on that sign also, right on the bottom. And we issued statements. We issued leaflets about that on all of the projects, that people who had any time after work, please come down. And we had, you know, people always around the whole park to see that there was no attack on the family or nobody going in and doing something drastic.
Oh, so there was like a picket surrounding the park?
It wasn't exactly a picket. It was always just groups of primarily by the signs, mm-hmm. group of men, three or four men maybe up at this corner here, and some of them down in the yard talking and walking through the park. It was all open with mm-hmm. trees, and no, it wasn't exactly a picket sign. We did have a picket line, I think, when we first did it, when we first got it established and put our signs up. We had some kind of a demonstration then, going around, I can remember at least one end of that park. But that would have been too difficult for us to maintain. And we didn't want to have anything petering off, so we just called it as a demonstration for the day.
But there was, in effect, like a patrol, though.
We sort of called them guards.
Uh-huh. And they were 24 hours, watches?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. People would come down there and stay for two or three or four hours. Other people would be leaving and coming, and it was something that just took on by, that just carried on by itself. No one had to organize or schedule that.
Mm.
That was just, I guess I'll go down and see mm-hmm. how they're coming out. I'll be down there for a couple of hours. And if they saw that there weren't enough people, they'd stay a couple of hours longer. If there were too many people, well, maybe they'd drive on and come back the next day or come back in the evening or whatever. And it was the single men that usually came down there at night.
Were people from the city coming doors to see this? Was
yes.
it viewed as a...
yes.
What was their reaction? Was it a mockery or were they moved by it at all?
Well, remember now, the majority of the city were workers. Sympathy was the biggest reaction, but there were also other people with big cars and it was a big juicy gossip item outside of the city also, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they would come to this really true, and the reactionaries and the anti-union people. Yes, they would come down and they're like, can't believe it. What's this coming? They're going to take over the town? Or, you know, revolution? What is this? And from our power lines, our public power lines, and all kinds of reactions to it. It was a remarkable, remarkably dramatic thing because it shook the whole city up. You know, even those who were unemployed, thought this is the way we were going to act. You know, they didn't want to get out there themselves, but after they saw the effectiveness of it, and there was no attempt to move a whole lot of people in there because we had difficulty trying to find the facilities, mm-hmm. you know.
Where did the food and things come from the 40 people initially?
I don't know. I know people used to bring hot dishes because they knew it was very difficult to cook down there. And they used to bring food. I think that work was done by mm-hmm. donations.
Mm-hmm.
And again, there was no organization required on that either. It just seemed as though this was that the WPA and the auto workers that had been with the union and those who had a couple of quarters, you know, they mm-hmm. were going to kind of oversee that these people were, the unemployed were, and their action was taken care of.
Yes.
And, of course, we always had the workers in the plant across in Buick, you know, when they're working, walking past those windows, they'd check every 2 or 3 minutes. There'd be people checking on it, see if there were any police coming mm-hmm. out. If there was any police cars pulling up at all, why, they just had the agreement. They were coming out mm-hmm. with their wrenches and whatever tools they had.
What was did the welfare, the people in the welfare office, which was across the street, react at all? Was there any visible sign on their part of reaction?
No, there was no visible sign at all. They didn't even see it as far as, you know, mm-hmm. their reaction. They didn't say anything. I'm sure that they wired the Lansing and wired Washington and it was going all over, mm-hmm. but they weren't going to let us know anything, what the reactions were.
But this is apparently when you're
saying that
in response to the death watch.
Must have been. I can't remember whether it was sent in at the time of the sit down and the effigy of the manager, or whether it was sent in as a result of the death watch. And you know, we had a number of other project demonstrations, shutdowns and demands and all kinds of things going on all the time. Yeah. So I don't know exactly when that was that they opened up the commodities, which they had said were absolutely non-existent.
Mm.
The Washington had said they couldn't send any more. They had wired the Lansing, and there was we were told over and over again, there was no further surplus commodities. You know what surplus commodities were then, don't you? That bully beef and cans and that ground-up coarse wheat that had a bitter taste to it. I think it must have been moldy, much of it.
Mm.
And there were some good things, dried fruits, and there were some good things that could exist on it. And the women used to exchange recipes. They had all kinds of ways of whipping up that stuff into more palatable concoctions.
Well, were there attempts to negotiate and meet with the welfare people all during the death watch, or was there very little communication going on?
Our officers were always trying to meet with them, but we got shut off. They just replied, well, we can't, our hands are tied.
Because apparently it was started as a specific response to these 900 families that had been cut off for years.
Yeah. And when they were cut off, they were, well, even before then, some of them were being evicted. Mm-hmm.
Do you remember anything about this Charles Adams family where he was evicted and they moved all the furniture into the park to where the death watch was going on? Do you recall anything about that?
Maybe that was the name of the family, with the woman who was the wife of the miner. Is that the one that...
Well, they described a family who it sounded like the death watch was already going on, and the truck drivers union, it wasn't teachers, it was some sort of drivers union, volunteered and took the furniture, which the city was going to move into store,
mm-hmm.
and put the family in centers, and they delivered the furniture right to where the death watch was, and they moved in the tents down there.
Yes, I vaguely remember. When I said that I thought some of the furniture from the eviction was brought mm-hmm. down there, that was the truckers. But when you report one incident like this, see, the truckers would help us out, and the electrical workers would help us out, and many workers would help us out.
What was the attitude of the AFL union supporters of this?
No.
They were the usual...
Craft, and they had no... used even then for mass production workers being organized. They were a bunch of uncouth, uncultured, untrained people. No. there might have been, you know, in every group, there might have been a few of mm-hmm. them. I can remember a couple of them in Chevrolet and Tool and Die that were great. They were absolutely great. Yes, they were. So there probably were some among the craft workers, too, but when it came to the plumbers and the carpenters, you'd have just individuals, not mm-hmm. the locals. Mm-hmm.
Well, and in fact, since it was a CIO affiliate, they probably couldn't have joined it in any event.
No. And their workers were probably employed mm-hmm. most of the mm-hmm. time.
Now, you know, apparently, there was some attempt. The death watch was still in operation 2 weeks later, and apparently you were trying to plan some sort of demonstration, you recall? And that's when there were some problems with the UAW and CIO leaders not cooperating, although they didn't initially come right out and say that they were opposed to it. Do you recall anything about that demonstration?
I remember that there were so many proposals at the time. There were people who actually wanted to take over City Hall. They wanted to go down and just occupy all of the offices and then say to the state government, what are you going to do? You can't operate here in this city for the majority of people. What are you going to do? And we couldn't see where we could maintain that kind of thing. And we didn't want any defeats. So I don't know. There were all kinds of demonstrations, and we had many demonstrations. I don't recall which one or... I remember vaguely that there were demonstrations in various parts of the town, too.
Were there large, were there membership meetings of the local in which the actions were decided on the demonstrations, or was it primarily by the officers?
Of the local unions?
Mm-hmm. I think of the local 12.
Oh, there were membership meetings. And then the executive board was empowered to take any emergency actions in the interim. But you must remember that even if we did that, these leaflets were going out so regularly that even if a person couldn't come down to a... I'm sorry, I haven't got the really good leaflets. If they couldn't come down to a meeting, they were informed.
Mm.
They were kept informed. They were informed not only by the steward on the job every morning with a fresh report, but then it was all outlined in written form at least once a week in leaflet form. Mm-hmm. And the discussions on WPA, these were just made work projects, many of them, were all about these tactics and all about what we were doing or should do or, you know, had done on the projects themselves daily. And the stewards were contacted by somebody from the union going around to see every day. And so that the information was fresh.
Then who would be the ones who communicated with the employees? That would be like you and the officers, since there wasn't any ongoing way to do that.
The unemployed very often would come up to the relief headquarters, and as they came up to the relief headquarters, there would be people in there from our union all day long contacting them. They didn't like it, but there wasn't much that they could do about it. We'd see them on the outside or we'd see them on the inside. There just wasn't a whole lot. You see, the whole town was in pretty bad shape. If you launched an attack by the police against the unemployed, the WPA workers would have come in right off the job with their shovels and picks. And if you launched an attack against the death watch, you had the factory workers across the street.
Mm-hmm.
But the unemployed were contacted mainly by when they came up to the relief headquarters, and we had our representatives in there. That's the way we learned about the evictions very often. Or the WPA workers on the job that say, my neighbor next door, they're coming out today.
Mm.
What do you say we just take off at lunch hour and go out there and move the furniture back in? And very often that happened.
Mm.
It was a period of great homogeneity in the city, because we were all just either coming out of a bad depression and just back to work, or going through the whole strike experience. Now, the whole Bureau of Division up there, that of Flint, was the best off of anybody in the city of Flint, because they had worked right straight through. But even then... they had people that they had laid off, and They had relatives that were in the other plants or on WPA or in, you know, on relief.
So even, it basically seems like it was, there was tremendous solidarity without ideology, really. But just
yes.
Solidarity in terms of the very concrete day-to-day
yes.
living
yes.
situations.
And the one lesson that they had learned from the strike is if you stick together, you can win. Mm-hmm. If you don't, well, you starve to death. That's the one thing that was uppermost in their minds.
Mm. Now, what I can't quite figure out is when the...
Now, on the WPA project, there was some foreman that tried to threaten the workers all the time by saying, if you do this or if you do that, you know, as the union is instructing you to do, we can lay you off. And, of course, there were firings from WPA, and we had grievances. We had grievance committees that would go... right out, Claude Workman was especially good on that. Go right out on the project. If a worker had been fired, he would go right out and take that worker and go right up to the foreman and fight it through. And
did the WPA administration formally recognize the grievance procedures?
Yes. I don't know whether they formally or informally
mm-hmm.
did, but it worked.
Mm-hmm.
It worked. Because they had a volatile situation there, you know, the whole project sit down until a man gets back to work. And other projects nearby would hear about it, and they would send words of solidarity over. I think that it was mainly they didn't want any more disturbance. They'd gone through a big strike, and they were having trouble within the union, UAW, and let this thing kind of go by itself and the company's efforts would have been, main interest would have been in supporting the Martin faction within the union that was going to be the permanent feature.
Mm-hmm. Now, I can't quite figure out when the death watch ended or what would have brought it to an end. Do you recall? It went on for at least 2 weeks, and then there's no mention of an ending or of a resolution. It suddenly disappeared from any report.
I believe that there was an end to the evictions.
Mm.
I think that there was some agreement that they would have a moratorium on further evictions and the separation of families. We ended the shelters at that time. They came out with some other excuse in the papers. They usually do, that the appropriations weren't enough for the shelters or God knows what, some kind of a cover-up thing. But when that happened, I think we found houses for those people and helped them move back in. And there was always so much activity going on, even when they found another house or found a place for them. They very often had to go up there, go around to other relatives and pick up their beds and their tables and their stoves or ice boxes or whatever, you know. And it just took the people to help, you know. There was no such thing as calling up and deliver this or send it back or something. And there were so many actions going on, just poor helping poor at that period. But the shelter system was discontinued. And I'm pretty sure then we pulled down the signs and claimed a big victory. We were always glad to end an action because we had so many other things going on all around. And then, you know, announce a big victory. That was, well, it was needed too for the morale of the people.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a victory.
Now, apparently, even at this point in May of 39, you were beginning to be under attack, it seems, and then that wasn't mentioned again until into the following year. Then the next thing that I came across seemed to be a resolution by the WPA division about inadequate relief and sending a resolution to the tax allocation board. There seemed to be continuing resolutions passed which could then go to the official agencies on an ongoing basis. One tactic. Then the next big thing was the national national WPA strikes.
Mm-hmm.
Which began in early July. They were going to cut back all the jobs beginning July 1st. The one in Flint was on the 11th of July. Do you recall anything about that? It was just a one-day strike.
Mm-hmm. I only recall that everybody just left their jobs, walked off, and And there again, I don't think anything was said to anybody who went back the next day.
Mm.
I don't think any issue was made. I think they wanted to keep that thing as quiet as they could the whole period.
Now,
we had to fight like the devil for any kind of publicity.
Now, at this point, Kermit was still on the project with digging the ditches, because I noticed that, the figure was that 3,600 of the 4,000 ditch diggers and seed project people walked out during that storm.
Oh, yes, he was definitely on it, because I remember there were a couple of projects where they had been threatened by the foreman or something like that, and he took crews around and shut those down. More than that, he and Claude Workman and Lawrence and Murray, there were two or three, or maybe more. They were isolated. And the foremen were particularly strong, and they told them anybody that walked off the job would need not come back the next day. So I guess they were procrastinating or something. They had marched in on the job and pulled their shovels out of their hands and led them right off the job. Yes, he was still there, I remember.
Mm-hmm. It seemed like there was inactivity. There was a drive to enroll all WPA workers at this point. The workers, I'm saying, about the Worcester Lions, because at this point, at the demonstration, the day of the strike, there was apparently a big demonstration at the post office of over 500 people, and Charles Lewis from the Fisher Body local, Claude Whitman and Kermit were defined as the leaders, and that's when they asked this guy from the Workers Alliance to say a few words. You're talking about that relationship then at that point with the Workers Alliance people?
I know that they were very reluctant to have anything to do with us, but I do remember that he did appear. I don't believe the rest of his the officers of the Workers Alliance came along. He was a halfway decent guy. I liked him. And he did appear. And made a very short speech. A very short speech. And that's all I remember. Mm-hmm. I guess the paper said afterward he came out and...
He basically extolled FDR, I guess.
And praised Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Yes. Oh, yes.
Then there seems to be after the...
By the way, we attacked Roosevelt a couple of times during the course of that WPA development. We were very careful about the way we did it because he was highly revered by many workers. But we did it as a challenge. And because we were respected, because there were so many people fighting together, they didn't think too much about it. They permitted those kind of... We attacked Roosevelt and his war budget and compared it to the cutbacks and the relief. But this, of course, is a big point of difference because the Workers' Alliance were all pro-Roosevelt.
Then it seems like there was a period of quiescence of the Union. I don't know, is this a period where there was some of the fight going on against you and... Boy, Lawrence, because it seems like there's this period of quiescence beginning about after the strike in July. They talked about holding meetings and resolutions for an independent labor party and an anti-war position. And then there are meetings. Several times you introduce resolutions, anti-war resolutions, and then this whole thing about the referendum. For voting on war and hostilities. Do you recall anything during that period?
I don't think that there were so many strikes and demonstrations. I think things had kind of leveled off where we were just carrying on the usual activities. Projects would have a project strike if the foreman got too tough or something. The dances were going on. Everything was sort of going... I don't think we had any big demonstrations during that period, but I can't be sure. The leaflets were continuing to go out all during the period on the job with instructions, with whatever information there was. And we were concerned about war appropriations in relation to the whole business of relief and feeding people and jobs. And I think we were beginning to talk about permanent jobs then, too. Permanent jobs instead of war appropriations.
Mm-hmm. That's beginning to come up, I think, at that conference, too. And then this conference occurred, which seems to have been under the... It seems like in other cities, the CIO, the UAW wasn't as directly involved in the formation of the locals, and the leadership of some of the locals would support the WPA workers, but that it wasn't the same kind of relationship as in Flint. And I there are a couple of women's names in that. There seem to be you and someone named Marie Nicole, Sister Hurst from Pittsburgh, another woman, Stillwagon from Pittsburgh, and Myrtle McKenna. The only women's names I come across on that. You were on the Resolutions Committee.
Well, now, that was only just a short conference of two or three days. We just met, and so I don't recall them nor their activities. Mm-hmm. And it seems as though the women probably would stand out, but they don't. In this case, they don't.
Was the conference called... Well, apparently Murray was involved in calling the conference, so the CIO must have been some way involved in calling the conference. Mm-hmm. But there was not the tie in the SWP between the conference and those people and...
No. No. Okay. None whatsoever. And when we got there, we didn't know any other, wait a minute, there might have been some socialists in on that, because I remember that I think the Steelworkers Organizing Committee was just in formation. You know, that was one union that was organized from the top down. And Clinton Golden came to address that conference from the Steelworkers Organizing Committee. I don't know whether he was then the president or he was one of the, or he had